Would you please now welcome our next presenter, Savas Dimopoulos, who will be discussing explorations of fundamental physics via the LHC, as well as smaller experiments, which will play a leading role in the future. Savas?
Yeah, I'm delighted to be here. My second favorite institution after Stanford. And so physics is a very ambitious enterprise. And here is the vast range of energy scales that a single physical theory is expected to describe. It goes from the Planck length all the way to the Hubble, to the size of the universe. And there is 60 orders of magnitude in between. So, so far, for the last 100 years or so, we've been focusing, at least particle physicists have been focusing in this small island of about eight orders of magnitude. The LHC explores these one or two orders of magnitude indicated by this orange. And possibly accidentally, right in the middle of that of this vast regime is the scale of dark energy, which also possibly accidentally coincides with the scale of neutrino masses. So this is the arena inside which physics takes place, and it's also a good way to represent some of the most outstanding problems that physics is facing today. The first is the so-called cosmological constant problem, which is simply the question of why is the universe so big, in particular, why it is so much bigger than all the Lagrangian parameters of the theory. This is the biggest problem in physics. There is no satisfactory solution known to date. And I will make a few comments about it, but I will not have much to say about it because it has not served us as a great guide for building models because it's such a hard problem. We simply don't have ideas. On the other hand, there is another problem, a smaller problem, which is called the gauge hierarchy problem, which has to do... The gauge hierarchy problem can be expressed in many ways. Perhaps the simplest way to express it is why is gravity so much weaker than electricity. For example, anytime I raise my arm, the electrical forces on my shoulder are able to overcome the gravitational attraction of the entire Earth. This is only possible because gravity is much weaker than electricity, and the question of why this is so is the essence of the hierarchy problem. It can also be expressed in a more common, usual way as the hierarchy between the weak interaction scale, which the LHC is exploring, and the Planck mass. Okay? In contrast to the cosmological constant problem, this has been a fruitful venue, at least for model building, for theorizing about what might be the next theory beyond the standard model. Now, what are possible approaches to the hierarchy problem? One is simply fine-tuning, which is like admitting defeat. It turns out that if you want to have this vast range of scales, like the vast difference between the weak scale and the Planck scale, one way to accomplish it is to very carefully choose parameters, to tune parameters to very high precision, 30 decimal precision, and have two big numbers cancel to that precision. This is not really a solution. It may be the way things are, but this is like admitting defeat, and that's one possibility. I should say that doing a fine tuning is not a logical contradiction. It is not a contradiction in the theory. However, it is an aesthetic appeal. When you have such hierarchy of scales, it begs for an explanation. The most popular framework for addressing the hierarchy problem are the so-called natural theories. And then there are environmental approaches and historical approaches. And I'll spend a little bit of time on each one of these possibilities. Let me begin with natural theories. Natural theories come in several categories. There are the so-called technicolor or composite Higgs models. There is large extra dimensions. And finally, there is supersymmetry, the supersymmetric standard model, which is by far the most popular of possibilities and the one that is looked at most intensely at the LHC. So I will talk a little bit about supersymmetry just to try to justify why it is so popular. Of course, one reason is it addresses the hierarchy problem. The second reason is something relatively unexpected. It explains the relative strengths of strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions. And in a way that the standard model does not. So for example, if you take the measured values of strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions and you extrapolate them in supersymmetric theories, you find that they meet as predicted by theories of supersymmetric grand unification. If you do the same for the standard model, they don't meet. So this is one of the main reasons why around the 90s, 10 years after the proposal of the supersymmetric standard model, theorists got increasingly convinced that supersymmetry is it, and it's around the corner, and LEP is going to see it, or maybe LHC is going to see it. And as you heard in the last lecture, this hasn't happened yet, but we have high hope that it may happen in the near future. So, what is the present state of affairs with supersymmetry? I'll just flash this one transparency. Maria spoke more about it. This is just a limit on specific supersymmetric particle masses. All of this colorful domain is excluded. And what you read from this is that supersymmetric particles, at least those that carry strong interactions, have to be heavier than about 2,000 GeV. Now remember, the weak interaction scale is about 200 GeV. So this discrepancy implies that all the theories that we have are tuned typically to less than a percent. Some, in fact, the vast majority, they are typically tuned to worse than one part per thousand or so. So this is the dramatic buildup for LHC 13, and as I said, this is where our hopes lie. Then there is another approach that is very controversial, and I think most days of the week, I think justifiably so, which is called the environmental approach. And to put it in the best possible light, I will start with a historical precedent. So once upon a time, people believed that the universe had only one solar system. And if you believe that, then the most important questions of physics are to understand that one solar system. For example, to understand the sizes of the planetary orbits, in particular, the distance of the Earth from the Sun. So these were the most outstanding problems in physics that people worked on, and they had intricate theories of platonic solids, etc. In addition, there are some mysteries associated with having one solar system. In particular, the biggest mystery is how come the conditions on the Earth are just right to allow for life to flourish? For example, if the Earth was a little closer to the Sun or a little further, it would be either too hot or too cold, and it wouldn't allow for life. In addition, the whole history of the Earth, the chemical history of the chemistry of the Earth, everything seems to be geared to our existence. So if you have one solar system, this becomes a big mystery. On the other hand, as we know now, there are the universe consists of many solar systems, 10 to the 22 or more solar systems. So in the presence of so many solar systems, the previous questions that I just, the question that I asked and the mystery that I pointed out just evaporate. The distance of the Earth from the Sun or the sizes of the planetary orbits are just historical accidents, and there is millions of planetary systems which have all kinds of distances of planets and a variety of conditions and different chemistry, etc. In addition, the mystery disappears. If you have so many solar systems, it is not surprising. There are some life-friendly environments in which we can exist. So, believing whether there is one solar system or many solar systems make a huge difference in the questions that you ask of physics. For example, imagine that there was a huge dense cloud surrounding our solar system, and it was so dense that we couldn't see any other solar system. Even then, believing that there are other solar systems would completely redefine the questions that one asks of our own. And now, with this favorable introduction, I will now make the analogy. Imagine that we've been too limited in our point of view, and that instead of one universe, there are many, many, many universes, each one with different physical laws. In such a universe, similar reasoning can be applied both to the cosmological constant problem, as Steven Weinberg has done, and to the gauge hierarchy problem, which makes these questions dynamically less relevant than we thought before. They are now amenable to either statistical reasoning or environmental reasoning. So we can argue about the magnitude of the cosmological constant or the magnitude of the gauge hierarchy on either statistical or what's called anthropic or environmental selection grounds. Okay. So this is the possibility. For the case of the hierarchy problem, I obviously don't have time to go into any details here. Environmental reasoning suggests two types of theories, two, and probably there are many more, but these are two that are favored on. One is split supersymmetry, which has some experimental predictions that can be tested at the Large Hadron Collider. And the other is a brand new theory I want to propose here, which is called just the standard model. It may well be, now I'm obviously not proposing that if we find just the standard model, this confirms the many universe theory, but it is one option that is consistent with it. So much for the environmental approach, except for an enormous caution. I want to give you a historic historic anecdote, which is, in fact, did happen. Many, many years ago, there was a professor at Harvard of biology called L.J. Henderson, who had a theory about atoms. And he tried to derive the properties of atoms by using biological arguments. He introduced the so-called biocentric principle, which its modern version is called anthropic or environmental. And he said that the properties of atoms have to adapt so that so they are friendly to life. Okay. Now, when did this happen? Well, this happened exactly at 1913, exactly the year when Niels Bohr proposed his theory of atoms. So there is a warning here. There is the fear of premature application of the biocentric principle, which may prevent further progress in physics. If people had taken this reasoning seriously in 1913, it might have prevented or at least delayed the progress of physics. So this is the dilemma. As I said, most of the days I think it's a crazy venue to follow, but occasionally I face the fact that maybe that's how the world is. You know, the world doesn't have to be the way we like it to be. We like it to be very predictive, and we like to be able, but it doesn't have to be like that, and that's definitely a possibility. The difficulty with this that I don't want to get to is to find ways to experimentally test the hypothesis. And this is a huge problem. In the case of the many solar systems, of course, the invention of the telescope and led to the actual discovery of extra stars or galaxies outside our solar system and settled the question observationally. There is no obvious observational signature, inevitable signature of the of this many universe approach. Then I will mention just a little bit about the so-called historical approach. So, an example of a small quantity that can be explained historically is the present energy density of the universe. I mean the energy density of matter in the universe. It's simply correlated to the age of the universe, to the longevity of the universe. So if you can explain the longevity of your universe, you can explain why the matter density is so small. Dirac tried to explain the small numbers of nature, in fact, the ratio of the proton mass to the Planck mass, by arguing that this ratio may be time dependent. Of course, today that theory of his is disproven experimentally. If that ratio was time dependent, then there are measurements. Big Bang nucleosynthesis would have proceeded differently, and there are detailed observations that disprove that. Similar ideas have been proposed, for example, by Abbott in the 80s as an approach to the cosmological constant problem. His attempts have led to an empty universe, and also he was suffering for really serious theoretical issues having to do with eternal inflation that I'm not going to go into, but he assumed that his theory was governed by classical equations when in fact it was vastly dominated by quantum chaotic jumps and that led to eternal inflation. So completely unpredictable framework. So, very recently, Graham, Kaplan, and Rajendran proposed a modified version of Abbott's ideas to address the hierarchy problem, the gauge hierarchy problem. It's still a brand new. This is a paper that is about 1 month old. It is an interesting idea. And it defines some new challenges, the challenges of understanding, for example, field values that are much bigger than Transplanckian, 10 to the 20 times the Planck mass, 10 to the 30. So one has to make sense of a theoretical framework where enormously large, as well as enormously tiny mass scales, like 10 to the minus 30 electron volts, can coexist at the same time. And these are very big and very small numbers in the same Lagrangian that beg for an explanation. But it's a possible venue. Their theories, at least technically, seems to be a natural theory. So it may be an interesting venue for the future. So this is as much as I had to say about LHC-related physics, gauge hierarchy problem. And now I will move to small-scale experiments, low-energy experiments. And of course, given the enormity, notice in this enormous ocean of possible mass scales, the things that we have explored in some detail cover about 20% of the energy scale, and there is a lot of scales left to explore. And it is natural to ask the question of why you know, bother about small-scale experiments. After all, we were taught, at least when I was a student, that, oh, if you want to study fundamental science, you study shorter and shorter distances. And I think this is just blatantly false on so many grounds. But the one that I want to point out here is that there are very well-motivated theories that predict new particles, like the axion or dilatons, moduli, new forces, new dimensions of space, extra dimensions of space, all what a particle physicist would call fundamental phenomena that can only, that manifest themselves at large distances, modifications of the laws of nature at large distances. So there is excellent theoretical motivation. There is also experimental motivation. Over the last 30, 40 years, there has been amazing advances in the fields of science that involve small-scale experiments. Atom interferometry, optics, condensed matter physics, quantum information, all kinds of fields that have blossomed. Many of them have led to a new frontier, which is called the high-precision frontier. Atom interferometry can, you know, measure things to 18, 17 decimals, and it's moving onward. With such a tremendous level of precision, one opens the possibility that you may be able to discover small deviations from laws of nature that indicate new phenomena at large distances. So there is a precision frontier. Also, there is the coherence frontier, which also offers possibilities for new types of detectors, etc. And finally, there is the sociological reason, which is that it is just a lot of fun to explore these things. As we know, the time scale between accelerators is increasing. The next big accelerator after LHC may take a decade or two, or more maybe. And this gives a lot of great ideas to test theoretical ideas with novel experimental techniques. In fact, this will be more like reverting to the past, to the glorious past of physics, you know, before the war showered us with a lot of funding and we went for big projects. We could go back to a case where theorists have to not only invent new theories, but they also have to propose a way to test them. They have to propose small-scale experiments. So here's like, Enrico Fermi and Felix Bloch are very much paradigms of such theorists that, and we may be going back to this era and where such small-scale experiments keep us happy, excited, and keep us making discoveries in between the times between accelerators. And we get complementary types of knowledge from that. So this I already, well, for the most part, I mentioned. So particles that are well motivated, even in the standard model, there is gravitons and cosmic neutrinos that involve low energy or large distance phenomena. And in string theories, there is a plethora of new phenomena. Axions, for example, is an extremely well motivated particle. It solves an outstanding problem, and it also is a good dark matter candidate. And kinetically mixing photons and all kinds of other particles or new particles or new dimensions can be seen by these techniques. Here is a small fraction of some of the experiments that are already either probing or have just been proposed to probe the new frontier. They go from cantilever experiments that look for new forces. Cantilevers are tiny, like diving boards, and if you bring a mass next to them, you can study if it experiences a force beyond gravity, if there is a force beyond gravity at small distances. These are tiny objects, like 100 micron objects. Then, of course, there is a bunch of experiments, and I'll mostly talk about, this is only a partial list, I'll just focus on atom interferometry for the purpose of this talk, just as an illustration, spend a few minutes with it, a few minutes of physics. So, in order to appreciate how great atom interferometry is, let us remind ourselves of photon interferometry.
Excuse me.
So in traditional photon interferometry, let's say we have a photon comes from the left, and there is a beam splitter which separates the wave function of the proton into an up-moving and a right-moving component. A mirror recombines the two components and makes them interfere after they go through another beam splitter. And you measure in the output ports. Now, the accuracy of the measurement. Now, what is the purpose of this? I mean, this goes back to, over 100, maybe 150 years. The basic idea is that if there is any difference in the physics, that the wave function of the photon that goes up encounters from the wave function of the photon that continues to the right encounters. In other words, if the component of the wave function of the photon that goes this way versus that way encounters different physics, then there is going to be a fringe shift that is caused by the different physics of the up-moving and right-moving component of the photon. And that will cause a fringe shift, which can be measured, and that's how Michelson was trying to look for the ether, etc. The accuracy of this measurement has to do with the wavelength of light divided by the size of the experiment. Okay. Now, exactly same experiment can be done with atoms, except now the axes are not x-axis and y-axis, but is time and space. Okay, so this is a space-time diagram of the following event. So take an atom. So here is an atom here. So take an atom, launch it perpendicular. This r-axis, this horizontal r-axis, actually corresponds to height. Okay, think of r as being the distance from the Earth. So you take an atom and you launch it perpendicularly. And then you throw a laser pulse that acts like a beam splitter that separates the atom into a fast component that, let's say, absorbed the photon, and a slow component that didn't. Okay? So now the fast component of the wave function arises above the slow one. Then there is another set of beam splitters that act like another set of laser pulses that act like mirrors, which convert the fast into a slow and the slow to a fast atom so that they catch up with each other and then they interfere. So this is the space-time picture that represents what I just... Oops. Sorry. Okay. So this space-time picture represents what I just told you. Okay, the atom, this is the slow component, this is the fast component, and then a mirror interchanges them and they come together and interfere. Okay. So again, if there is any physics in the upper path, any difference in the physics in the upper path versus the lower path, you will see this will manifest itself as a fringe shift. The big point about atoms is that atoms don't move at the speed of light. In fact, they can be made very slow. This means that the duration of this experiment can be very long. It can be, let's say, of order of a second. If the experiment I described to you happens at a height, if you have an interferometer like I described, which is 10 meters high, it takes about a second for atoms to fall 10 meters. And therefore, during that second is a very long time during which you can pick up minuscule physics differences in the upper and lower trajectory. This is as if you have an interferometer, one of whose arms is from here to the moon, a light second. And the other one can be 10 meters or... So it's a very big interferometer because of the slowness of atoms. You just have more time to accumulate physics differences. So this experiment now has been going on for a while. The building up the experiment has been on for a while. Now they've reached a point, and my colleagues at Stanford, professors at Stanford, Hogan and Kasevich, have been going at it for a while. Now they've reached a point where the maximum separation between the wave function of a single atom is 58 centimeters. So this is amazing. So they have a Schrödinger cat state who's made out of atoms whose separation is 58 centimeters. And now they are getting ready to do some physics measurements and test general relativity. So let me explain, let me just describe to you. This is the very simple part, the theoretical part. Is first they want to test the equivalence principle. Now, Galileo had already tested it. In fact, he tested it by using, this is an oversimplification, he wasn't throwing things. He was using inclined planes to slow down the motion, and he was testing equivalence principle using that. So he was testing it to order one. Now, future experiments, such as the one that I described to you using interferometry, can go to 17 decimals. And there, instead of dropping a coin and a feather or whatever it was you want to describe it, you will be dropping a rubidium-85 and a rubidium-87 atom. So these have different objects, they have different masses. But because they're both rubidium, they have the same chemistry, the same, so they have the same backgrounds. So it's a very favorable way to do the experiment. So essentially what you're doing is you're doing Galileo's experiments by dropping rubidium-85 and 87 and checking if they fall at the same rate. So that's something that they tell me now they're ready to start doing and hopefully have results. They feel that they can reach 15 decimal tests of equivalence principle in a few, well, in a short time, a few months, and go to 16 and 17 decimals. I should say for comparison, the equivalence principle is presently tested to about 3 parts in 10 to the 13 using, for example, lunar laser ranging. And which is the experiment that shows that the degree to which the Earth and the Moon fall at the same rate towards the Sun. Okay. So that's known to 13 decimals. And so that's the very first thing they will do now that they have this amazing Schrödinger cat state. And then they'll test general relativity, for example. In general relativity, there are corrections. This is Newton's law. Acceleration is equal to force. But then there are additional corrections. The first correction here that you see is because gravity gravitates. What I mean by that is that there is mass or energy stored in the gravitational field of the Earth, for example, which contributes to the inertia to the mass of the to the Earth, and so this has to do with the fact that gravity gravitates, or what particle physics is called the three graviton coupling. A graviton moves and it couples to another graviton. So this is called the three graviton coupling, and it has already the equivalence principle experiments that have been done, for example, through lunar laser ranging. Are testing the equivalence, are measuring the three graviton coupling to a precision of one part per thousand. In other words, they show with a precision of one part per thousand that the coupling of gravity to matter and the coupling of gravity to graviton is the same. Okay, that's an amazing thing. The three graviton vertex is actually better known than the three gluon vertex that enters in strong interactions in quantum chromodynamics. Okay, so that's the second term, which can be measured. The third term is simply the fact that if you, kinetic energy is a form of energy which gravitates. So these types of terms will be tested in not in the first generation of experiments, but in later generations. You can also build gravitational wave detectors using these techniques. I don't have time to go into this. Essentially, the idea is you take two interferometers, like two 10-meter interferometers, you separate them by a large distance, say, you know, 1,000 kilometers, and you essentially laser range the relative position all the time. If a gravitational wave that, let's say, comes into the board, then it will change the distance, it will cause an oscillation to the distance between the two interferometers, which you can pick up via this laser ranging. And this proposal, it dates back to several years ago. There is some interest in this proposal that is, and it is, there is currently some NASA funding that is supporting doing some engineering studies related to possible satellite mission involving this proposal. And there is also an Earth version of this experiment that was also proposed. Essentially, if you go, it turns out that if you go inside a mine, a place which is quiet, more quiet than the surface of the Earth, you can do the same experiment with some diminished sensitivity, of course, but you reduce the seismic noise. And there is an experimental proposal by Philippe Boyer, who spent 3 years at Stanford and now is back in France and building such an experiment just in Bordeaux, just under the vineyards in Bordeaux. So I would very much like to visit him. And the projected sensitivity of space experiments, this is this proposal that I just mentioned, the previous transparency, is called AGES. And this is a comparison of possible reaches of AGES versus the LISA proposal. Notice that AGES is relatively small. It's 1,000 kilometers instead of 5 million kilometers, in large part, because of what I was saying before. Because atoms move slowly, you can check the same periods with a much more compact instrument. Okay. So it can be much smaller, and it also has different space control requirements, spaceship control requirements, etc. So it's an interesting direction that is being explored. So summary, at least, just for atom interferometry, these are things that are happening in that are planned to happen at Stanford from equivalence principle to very short distance tests at gravity. And the test of atom neutrality that I didn't mention. Test of atom neutrality is a proposal that actually Mina made here. Presently, the electrical neutrality of atoms is known to 1 part in 10 to the 22. She proposed an experiment where you can go to 30 decimals, which is very interesting. This is, gives you an idea of how much you can jump in precision by using these new techniques. So, just to wrap it up, so there is, I just spoke about an extremely small subset of experiments. There is a number of things, some of them proposed and some of them already happening that I've sort of drawn here based on very different physics techniques, from nuclear magnetic resonance to cantilevers to optically levitated objects to atom interferometers, of course, ADMX and light through wall experiments, and many more that are happening. And there is the following interesting question to ask. Is there any value in taking this large variety of experiments that happen in different institutions with essentially isolated, relatively isolated experimentalists, and bring them all in one home? So is there any value to what, we creating a home for such experiments we can call the super lab for fundamental physics? So before, so let me define what one possible vision of one may mean about a super lab. It's a laboratory housing many small scale experiments. It's a laboratory of laboratories, if you wish. And the main focus of these experiments is to study fundamental physics. What do I mean by fundamental physics? Well, because I'm a particle physicist, I mean what particle physicists mean. Searches for new forces, for new particles, for new dimensions, new phenomena outside the realm. This of standard model, beyond the standard model physics. So can one, so the focus is doing beyond the standard model physics using any experimental technique. So it is not tool driven, but it is completely driven by this beyond the standard model physics searches. And it operates pretty much in the high energy physics model of a mostly user facility with some local personnel at all levels, you know, from faculty to machine shop and you know, computer people, all the support that one needs to do good physics. Okay. So, what are here are some points in favor of such an idea. So first, it gives some new physics opportunities. For one thing, it has the virtue of being an ideas incubator. And this is an old idea going to the Academy of Plato in Athens, that if you bring a lot of smart people under one roof and you let them interact, you get much more than the sum of its parts. There are coherent effects. So that is an obvious sociological advantage. That you have an ideas incubator, you have shared lab responses, resources, which is also a big advantage. You avoid duplication of one that you have if you have experiments that are separated. And it's also interesting because it, in a sense, defines a new field. The field, you see, the field of doing fundamental physics was renamed high-energy physics, and I'm stuck with this name. I'm a high-energy physicist, and I don't like it because I want to be considered just a physicist. And there is no name for this field that, you know, I'm pursuing. It's just called, oh, doing, you know, beyond the standard model physics with large-scale experiments, or with small-scale experiments, or with large-distance experiments. So the fact that it defines a new field is important, and is important when it comes, for example, to funding agencies. My experience with friends of mine trying to do these experiments is that when they write proposals, they don't get funded either from the, you know, high energy funding budget or from the, let's say, atomic physics budget, because it falls in between. It combines the two. It wants to do beyond the standard model physics. So having a new field defined by, for example, the existence of such laboratory or laboratories would be also used. It would give an identity to the field. Now there is tremendous sociological opportunities. The most important, perhaps, is that it gives new exciting things for young people to become interested in beyond the short distance frontier. And there is a lot of, you know, fun physics and fun beyond the standard model physics to explore. So it will keep them happy and relevant during the times, the decade or two decade long times that it takes for accelerators to come up, as we said before. And finally, these experiments are small enough scale. Even the super lab, even, you know, one big super lab is small enough that private funding can have big impact on this. This is in big contrast to accelerator physics. For example, there is maybe one or two people on Earth that can afford a collider, like Bill Gates, maybe, and a few others. So it is hard to imagine making an impact without huge public commitment, which in the case of CERN is even, you know, the whole world contributing. In contrast, you can make huge impact with, you know, expenses on the other of 100 million. You can build such a lab, at least the building, such a laboratory facility, and create a new facility that, for example, may discover, let's say, the axion. The axion will have as big impact, I think, comparable impact to the discovery of the Higgs. And it's a much smaller project, both in terms of money, people, and a time that it takes to perform such an experiment, yet it can have a very big fundamental impact discovery. Finally, it gives a new vision for investing public resources, which again is becoming an important issue, for example, for laboratories in the United States like Fermilab and SLAC, how to diversify. It gives them a direction to diversify in when they stop doing high energy physics. And so for all these reasons, I think it's an idea to explore for the community. And it will be, I think the last 50 years of physics have been spectacular. And as far as physics of the standard model is concerned, it mostly came from accelerator physics, the progress. I think the next 50 years are likely to be different. I think we will have an era where both high-energy experiments and low-energy experiments will play an equal role in discovering new laws of nature. Thank you.
Thank you, Savas. We have time for a couple of questions.
Hi. What do you think the role of astrophysics and cosmology is in informing the types of things to be doing in these small scale experiments?
Oh, the role of I cannot see you. Where?
Over here.
Oh, hi. Yes. What is the role of astrophysics to what? You said I didn't hear the question.
Just in general, what's the role of astrophysics in overlapping with these small-scale experiments?
Oh, absolutely. The role of astrophysics has already been huge in the sense, for example, of looking for particles such as the axion that I was mentioning before, and so far not discovering any evidence for it, but putting tremendous constraints on all kinds of fundamental ideas that involve elementary particles, including the axion in particular. So astrophysics has a huge role to play. By the way, I was not talking about astrophysics. This was not the focus on my talk, but it's a well-known fact that astrophysics plays a huge role, for example, in constraining the dark matter properties, the axion properties, and the properties of many weakly interacting particles. And one of the ways in which it plays a role, in fact, as you know very well, weakly interacting particles tend to be emitted by the whole volume of, let's say, a supernova or a red giant. So they, by the very fact that they're weakly interacting, they can lead to much bigger a priori energy loss, and therefore the absence of observing such energy loss gives tremendous limits for new beyond the standard model particles. I expect that astrophysics is in good shape. It has several ongoing projects, and it will continue to contribute great knowledge to elementary particle physics.
Hi. The graviton still has not been detected, right? I mean, it's always spoken of as factually existing, but I mean, I know something has to be carried with the gravitational force, but it still has not really, it's still not been detected.
No, the graviton, first of all, gravitational waves have not yet been directly detected, although there is very strong evidence, indirect evidence, for their existence. The gravitational waves have not been detected. Hopefully, this will stop being true in like 5 years, because Advanced LIGO is starting operation. And I think the next big excitement, in physics outside the LHC, let's say, may well come from Advanced LIGO. So Of course.
So you drew the parallel between the solar system mm-hmm. and you know, the discovery of many other solar systems, which seemingly would justify a view that perhaps there are many more universes as well. But I want to ask you, I mean, in your opinion, given that what we've discovered on the largest scales probed in the universe is a convergence towards simplicity, it's quite extraordinary how uniform, simple, what do we have, Gaussian random noise, nearly scale invariant on the large scales. Given that, do you consider that evidence? Why should that not be some evidence against the idea that the universe becomes horrendously complicated on even larger scales? So the solar system measurements gave no indication that we were converging towards a simple, you know, final, larger state. On the contrary, the cosmological observations do give an evidence. Do you consider this evidence against the multiverse?
I would think it's too strong to call it evidence, because the multiverse does predict a very sort of inhomogeneous universe, but in enormously longer scales.
So you have to go to simplicity.
And then complexity again. And as I told you, me and probably every other human that has thought about this thing spends most of their time not believing the multiverse. And I definitely fall in this category. But I'm also willing to admit that there are things that are true that I do not like. So me not liking something is not a necessary criterion of whether it's true or not.
And what you're saying, there's nothing we can do to gain evidence.
That is the real problem. So there is a very deep problems like, is it science? Can, for example, why can't we just say, oh, there is, you know, some benevolent creature that takes care of things and you know, makes the cosmological constant small for us to exist and for him or her to make fun of. And it is experimentally not distinguishable the way it stands right now from postulating a benevolent creature or, you know, divine intervention that takes care of the cosmological constant of the weak scale to make sure that, you know, the galaxies form and atoms form. So there is no difference that we know right now, experimentally feasible differences that we can even imagine between the story of divine intervention and of the multiverse. And that is the problem. That is the problem. This is, again, in contrast to Galileo or to Giordano Bruno's speculation about many solar systems, for which the justification came relatively soon.
Michael Brooks from New Scientist magazine.
Yes.
I have a question about surprises and the value of surprises. And many of the experiments that you're suggesting we do are unlikely, I would say, to give us many surprises. Tests of the equivalence principle, looking for changes in the gravitational constant at small distances, and various other things. Is there a danger that the kind of institute you're talking about setting up will actually tell us things to greater decimal places, but actually not give us any surprising information?
Yeah, this is a fantastic question that actually comes up when I talk to some of the experimentalists that I would be interested in having in such a laboratory. And it is true. For one thing, I want to defend, let's call it, negative experiments, experiments that don't find anything. And this is a very easy job for me to do. I will just allude you to the Michelson-Morley experiment. So negative results do add to knowledge. Knowing what is not true is very important. It is obviously nowhere near as exciting as discovering something concrete. But so beyond this, I should say that it is not necessarily just a wild chase of things that may be true. For example, axions. Axions are very well motivated particles. They solve an outstanding naturalness problem. And by the way, that is a naturalness problem that is so hard that not even Anthropics can solve it, which is a strong statement for those of you who are familiar with Anthropic reasoning. So it solves an outstanding problem. It's a beautiful dark matter candidate, and it can be detected. So I think searches for axions are extremely well motivated. Then there are less motivated phenomena, such as deviations from equivalence principle. I admit that my friends at Stanford, who are now setting up to do the experiment, do not expect, any more than I expect, to find deviations. And in fact, they are worried that if they do find deviations, they'll have to work like hell to think about backgrounds and what did I really do wrong. And so I agree with you that that is more, you know, a sort of proof of principle. Oh, I can go to 16, 17 decimals. The previous people went only to 13. That is the feeling. Of course, we could be wrong. We've been surprised. It does explore. So exploring new regions in parameter space is very much progress in science. I want to make actually a more general point. Many people think that science progresses by having a few people sort of thinking like that, like, you know, there was Maxwell and there was Einstein, then there was Newton, and they were holding their heads. And this is not how science is. Science is very much a human thing. And not knowing what is true, for example, the case of Einstein, not knowing the result of the Michelson-Morley experiment was crucial for the logical, you know, for the beginning of the theory of relativity. So it is not knowing what is true is gaining in knowledge. The other thing that plays a role is good teaching of science. That's something that's not emphasized. It's obviously not part of my talk. But I find, for example, through teaching, that it improves my understanding, and I also present things much better than the original things. And then the students come back with even better ways of understanding things. And I think this is part, science is very much a live part of our culture, where thousands of people make contributions. And it's not just the delta functions. Oh, Heisenberg, you know, got sick and thought of the uncertainty principle. It's science is not a collection of delta functions. It's a collection of knowledge that is gained slowly, and it spreads from, you know, elementary schools, high schools, universities, and then it becomes a live cultural organism. So I think it is very important. I agree that. It is a major point. For example, I'm responsible for some experimental is looking for things that have not been seen. And sometimes they come back to me and say, they point at me and say, ah, you know, I didn't find what you predict. Well, I'm sorry, it was a good idea. I didn't tell you to work on it. So it's I agree with you, though, that I'm having this difficulty. I'm trying to collect experimentalists, and they say, what if I find nothing? And gravitational waves, by the way, is a contrast to this. Everybody believes they are there. In fact, in a sense, they are so obviously there that one has to struggle with what do we mean by have been seen. I mean, this is a very, I think they've been seen, well, indirectly. And what do you mean by indirectly? I mean, it is obvious that they have to be there. So gravitational waves, though, are something that will be seen. The one thing that I discussed today that I feel confident about, if will be seen, hopefully at advanced LIGO, so we don't have to wait long, but also future experiments. Of course, by the way, the gravitational waves, I don't view the value of gravitational waves in finding the wave. I view the value as creating a new eye to the universe. This will be an amazing tool, looking at the universe completely differently than we've been seeing it up to now, where, you know, very dramatic early events, you know, the creation of the universe, black holes, etc. That's what we'll be mostly seeing, not that little stuff that we call ordinary matter, etc. So you'll see amazing phenomena. So I think the reason why I think even after advanced LIGO hopefully discovers gravitational waves, it's very important to pursue either LISA or AEGIS or hopefully both, is that in the future of humanity lies gravitational wave astronomy, which will be one of the most. Every time we build observatories at different frequencies, infrared, ultraviolet, we discover new things. So gravitational waves will be a direction to go to. So the value of what my colleagues at Stanford are doing, you know, with the 10-meter interferometer, may not be that they'll discover deviations from the equivalence principle, but it may be that it's a stepping stone towards the setting up a gravitational wave detector. And that is a worthwhile enterprise.
So I'm afraid with that, we need to call the morning session to a close.